Yes. Is that me?
This is yours.
Oh, it's that one.
Because we're jumping it.
Sarah keeps turning. Thank you for your patience. Welcome to the California Coastal Commission meeting for Thursday, December 11th. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Commissioner Blank.
Here.
Commissioner Burke. Commissioner Clark.
Present.
Commissioner Weso.
Here.
Commissioner Kruer.
Here.
Commissioner Riley.
Here.
Commissioner Schellenberger.
Here.
Commissioner Wine. Chairman Neely.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. And we're starting off the meeting this morning with a workshop on ex parte communications.
Madam Chair.
Peter.
Before we begin with the workshop, can we go over the changes on the agenda and kind of the ground rules for
okay,
today?
Certainly.
That's all right with you.
Yes. Jack. Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the audience, if you wish to speak on an item on today's agenda, please fill out a speaker slip and give it to Commission staff. The slips are located on a table just outside the chamber. And when in a chamber, please turn off all cell phones or other wireless devices. These devices interfere with our webcast. In addition, we have some special rules we all must adhere to rigorously. One, no waste paper may be left in the chamber on the desks or in the seats or benches. Eating and drinking are not allowed in the chamber at any time. Please do not move any of the desks or chairs between one another. And please do not mark or write on any of the benches, which I think goes without saying. And standing is not allowed in a legislative chamber here, so please sit down when you're in the chamber. Next, I'll go over today's agenda changes, starting on page 8. And our notes pages on page 8 or 9. So moving on to page 10. Item 10A, the Haynes application, is postponed. Item 10B, the Sandrum application, moving to consent. 10C, the Halbrecht application, moved to consent. Moving on to page 11. Item 13A, City of Manhattan Beach appeal, is postponed. Item 14A, LA County Department of Public Works application, moved to consent. Moving on to page 12, item 18A, the Nador application, moved to consent. On page 13, item 21A, Party Homes, moved to consent. And item 22B, the City of Oceanside LCP Amendment 1-07 has been withdrawn, and this has been replaced with item 22C, which is in your addendum to the agenda with the City of Oceanside LCP Amendment 2-08. There was a numbering issue there, so we had to put that on the addendum to the agenda. Next, I will turn, next item is item 3, and I will turn that over to Chief Counsel Hope Schmelzer.
Thank you, staff.
Thank you. We are presenting a workshop on ex parte communications. The workshop will be presented by staff attorney Alex Halperin. We will have a PowerPoint presentation that we'll be showing you during the presentation. It will be available on our website after the meeting. This workshop is being presented pursuant to an agreement with CLEAN, which came out of the CLEAN versus California Coastal Commission litigation about Diablo Canyon power plant. And with that, let me introduce staff counsel Alex Halperin.
And Madam Chair, if you have problems hearing us because the acoustics in this room really are a little difficult sometimes, please don't hesitate to let us know.
Thank you.
I've not worked with this system before, so is the PowerPoint ready? Do I just push a button here? Great. Okay. There we go. Good morning, commissioners. I'd like to begin by defining the phrase ex parte communications and giving you a brief history of the rules that have applied to this commission and why the subject is so important. The direct Latin translation of ex parte is by or for one party. The phrase is used in law generally to refer to proceedings or communications that are brought by one person in the absence of another, which obviously raises issues of fairness. And it's these sorts of fairness concerns that are the commission's rules are designed to address. To understand how ex parte concerns apply to this commission, it's important to understand that the vast majority of what you do at these hearings is to act in what's known as a quasi-judicial or quasi-adjudicative capacity, which means you're acting much like a court adjudicating a matter that comes before it. Although the degree of controversy surrounding any given project varies widely, many matters you see are entirely non-controversial, unlike in most court cases, you're still performing the same basic functions as a court, in the sense that you're holding a hearing, listening to a presentation of facts, and applying the law, in this case the Coastal Act and regulations, to those facts in order to come to a decision. And the law is clear that, as a result, the constitutional guarantees of due process, which includes basic fairness principles, applies to your hearings just as it does in a court of law. This slide shows some quotes of court cases applying that rule in administrative hearings. Moreover, the legislature clearly intends these concepts to apply to this agency. In adopting the ex parte rules for the Coastal Commission that I'll be discussing in detail in a couple of minutes, the legislature simultaneously adopted specific findings to that effect. Here you see those findings. Note the legislative emphasis on the importance of conducting your affairs in an open manner and in fostering public understanding of and participation in that process. Accordingly, it's clear that you owe a duty to the parties that come before you to proceed in a manner consistent with these principles of fairness and due process. In addition, as I'll discuss later, as a practical matter, if you fail to observe these principles, your decisions may be at risk of being overturned. But due process is an elastic concept, and what it requires in any given circumstance often varies quite a bit. For most of this commission's history, whether commissioners could engage in ex parte communications was not entirely clear, but at a minimum, such communications were highly suspect, as courts generally frown upon such contact. For example, in the landmark case of English versus City of Long Beach in 1950, on the general issue of ex parte communications and administrative agencies, the California Supreme Court held that where the members of a city's civil service board relied in making their decision on evidence they had received outside of the hearing without disclosing it, they had failed to give the parties a fair hearing. This slide shows some of the language from that case. Note the court's emphasis on the fact that the board members could not act on their own information or consider anything that was not introduced at the hearing. On the basis of that case and other similar cases, from as far back as 1974 until at least 1988, the Attorney General's office consistently advised that commissioners discourage parties from attempting to provide them with information outside of the hearing or avoid them entirely, and if they did occur, to disclose them. Much more recent judicial pronouncements, such as a 2006 California Supreme Court case, have suggested that any ex parte communications can present due process issues, as indicated in the first quote on this next slide. And as referenced in the second quote, even before that case came out, back in 1995, the legislature overhauled the State's Administrative Procedures Act, or APA, to, among other things, impose a general prohibition on such communications with limited exceptions. That prohibition applies generically to all state agencies, unless an exception applies. But going back to the prior slide, and I'm not sure if I can do that easily on here, but you can see that this in the second quote, that perhaps the most critical issue is ensuring that if such communications do occur, they're disclosed so that parties are aware of the evidence influencing the agency's decision and have an opportunity to refute or explain it. And indeed, just a few years before the state APA was overhauled in 1995 to include those strict limitations on ex parte communications, the legislature adopted ex parte rules specifically for this commission, which expressly permit ex parte communications, but only provided that they are disclosed as required by that statute. Those disclosure requirements are key. They're key to the fairness principles I've been discussing, because they ensure that the parties know what you've heard, so that there are no hidden facts influencing your decisions, and if someone disagrees with what you've been told, They have the opportunity to respond and present their own view of the facts. Having all the facts that form the basis of your decision on the record so that everyone knows what they are has an additional practical advantage as well. If your decisions are challenged, the standard of review requires that there be substantial evidence in the record to support your decision. So if evidence is left out, the Attorney General's office is at a disadvantage in defending your decisions. Finally, it's necessary to promote the openness principles in the Coastal Act's findings, as these disclosure requirements guarantee that you make your decisions in a manner that ensures that the general public is aware of the basis for your actions. So with those principles in mind, the rest of my presentation will focus on the nuts and bolts of the rules that the legislature adopted for the Coastal Commission. Coastal Act provides its own definition of ex parte communications, and as you see in this next slide, the bold text indicates terms within the definition that are defined themselves in other sections of the Act, and I'll talk about those next. But first, you can see that this definition applies to any oral or written communication that you have outside the official record with an interested person about a matter within your jurisdiction. So that includes meetings, phone calls, as well as documents you receive, email messages, any other type of communication. It also includes any individualized communications you receive during the hearings. For example, if you receive a call on your cell phone or an email message while you're at the hearing. Next, the definition states that it applies to communications about matters within the Commission's jurisdiction. This next slide shows you the definition of matters within the Commission's jurisdiction. And you can see the definition is very broad and really applies to almost any sort of application for a permit or a plan or an amendment that comes before you. If an application has been submitted and you'll be making a quasi-judicial decision on that application, the matter is subject to your jurisdiction. But as noted in the underlined text at the end of the slide, the application has to have been submitted. Until there's an application on file, communications about a future matter are not ex parte communications. As I'll discuss later, one thing you'll notice is not included in this list is enforcement matters. And the Attorney General's office has advised the commissioners not engage in ex parte communications concerning enforcement matters because of the heightened judicial nature of those proceedings. And the Deputy AG, Ms. Patterson, can discuss this with you further. The next slide here shows the definition of interested person. The concept is really pretty self-explanatory. Anyone who wants to talk to you about a matter that will be coming before you and urge you to take a position is most likely an interested person. Applicants, their agents, employees, other people with a financial interest in the matter, or their representatives, concerned neighbors, environmental groups, civic groups, etc. If you have a question about whether someone is an interested party, you should probably assume that they are. There are also some specific exclusions from the definition of ex parte communication, and this slide shows a list of types of communications that are specifically excluded. You don't need to worry about communications with your staff, or communications on procedural issues. For example, if someone stops you in the hall and asks you when we're going to reconvene, that's not an ex parte communication. Many of you serve on other state or local bodies, and you can see the communications you have in your official capacities on those boards, even if they're about matters that will come before this commission, are not ex parte communications. And finally, there are some exclusions for communications by non-voting members of the commission. As I mentioned before, the legislature has made it clear that ex parte communications are generally allowed, provided you comply with the disclosure requirements. However, they're never mandated. You're not required to take ex parte communications. No one has a constitutional or a statutory right to engage you outside of the official record. Some of you don't take ex parte communications. Even those who do take them may not be available for them at all times, and you have no obligation to make yourself available. In addition, as indicated in one of the prior slides, showing matters within the Commission's jurisdiction, the allowance for ex parte communications covers a wide range of actions, but it doesn't list enforcement actions, as I mentioned before. And because enforcement actions are more like prosecutions, with your staff serving as prosecutor and the alleged violator as defendant, the Attorney General's office has advised us that the heightened due process requirements for such hearings make ex parte communications inappropriate in that context. It would be as if someone accused of something were to go to talk to the judge in advance of his or her trial. And then there will be cases of overlap. So when your staff is actively engaged in bringing you an enforcement proceeding regarding a situation that's also the subject of a pending application, attempting to engage in ex parte communications regarding the application without also engaging in ex parte communications regarding the enforcement matter is generally going to be too difficult a distinction to make. And although there's no bright line rule about when the overlap precludes all ex parte communications, we advise that you err on the side of caution, and especially if the factual bases of the two matters are the same, not engage in ex parte communications in that context. And of course, you should feel free to talk to us if you have any questions in those kinds of complicated situations. Next, I'd like to review the disclosure requirements. As indicated above, when you engage in allowable ex parte communications, it's critical, nevertheless, that you comply with the disclosure requirements. Again, in order to comply with the statute, to protect the integrity of your decisions, and even to protect yourselves from personal liability. Sorry, this is the next one. So first, disclosures must be on the record. If communication occurs more than 7 days in advance of the hearing on the matter discussed in the ex parte communication, you have to complete the disclosure form and get it to staff before the meeting begins. If the communication occurs in the 7 days before the meeting, you have to disclose the communication on the mic, and you should submit it in writing on the form as well. Disclosures have to identify who was involved, where and when it occurred, and a complete description of the communication. And it's that last factor that's obviously the one that is subject to some discretion on your part to determine exactly what you need to say. Clearly, you're not expected to transcribe everything that occurs in a conversation that you have. However, you do need to bear in mind that one of the key purposes of the ex parte disclosure requirements, in addition to general transparency in the governmental process, is to allow interested parties to understand what you've learned that may be influencing your decision, so that if they have a different perspective on it, they can get on the mic and disagree or explain or share their perspective so that you have the benefit of both sides. So if someone gives you a thorough explanation about why their project should be approved, and you just say that you talked to someone about the project and they say you should approve it, that's not really complying with the statute or with its purpose. There has to be enough in your report so that someone in the audience can understand what you were told and be able to respond to it. And as indicated on this slide, at the end, you should be sure to also send all written communications to staff so that they have a copy, and they'll include any significant issues in the staff report so that people have the opportunity to respond to those as well. There's also an additional prohibition in Section 30327, which basically says that if you do engage in ex parte communications and you don't disclose them, you can't participate in the decision or attempt to influence the decision or other commissioners. And finally, I wanted to remind you that failure to comply with the disclosure requirements or the recusal requirement that I just mentioned can also expose you to potential civil fines and attorney's fees. And as you can see, those fines can be up to $7,500 for any individual transgression. And in terms, lastly, of protecting the integrity of your decision, the statute does expressly provide for a party to seek a court order revoking your action if there's a violation of the provisions regarding ex parte communications. So that concludes my presentation, and I'll remain available for questions.
All right, thank you, staff. We have three speaker slips on this item. So let's go to the first speaker, which is Marcia Hanscom.
How's that? Okay. Honorable Commissioners, Marcia Hanscom with the Coastal Law Enforcement Action Network, or CLEAN. And as you heard, the subject of this workshop is a result of litigation that we brought because we were concerned about some ex parte communications that we believed were not only not revealed, but also not properly disclosed. And We're actually a little concerned. While we appreciate the presentation that was just made, and we hope that that presentation could be made available not only to you but to the public and also to new commissioners in particular, we would ask for a subsequent hearing. This is really not what we contemplated. We would have a very wide communication about this workshop, and opposing counsel, Rick Zabur from PG&E, told me yesterday that he only found out about it Tuesday. I only found out about it Tuesday. While it was in the agenda, we had thought that both the applicants' representatives as well as the public interest groups would be notified far enough in advance that we'd be able to have a really full workshop. We think this is a very serious issue. Obviously, it was a big issue to the governor because one of the commissioners was replaced related to ex parte communications over the last couple of years. So we think that this this needs a further broad discussion. And we do think that in terms of why this is important, not only fairness for fairness sake, which is really important in Coastal Commission process, but we also think so that you make the best decision. If, for instance, one side of things says to you the sky is green and the other side doesn't know that that has been said and they have evidence that the sky is blue and they need to tell you that, then there's just no way to counter that information that could be influencing your decision if we don't know that. So the proper disclosure is not just about saying we met and we all talked about the same thing this other guy said we met, but what exactly was said of substance that could be influencing your decision? We think that that's very, very important to in terms of having disclosure. We actually believe, contrary to some folks, that ex parte communications are very, very important. We think they should happen, and partly because of the nature of application process. Often your staff has literally hours of time with the applicants, and the public interest side doesn't get to have that much time. Sometimes we can't even get phone calls returned because your staff is so stretched and doesn't have enough time to meet with us ahead of time. So having these opportunities to talk with you about these processes we think are very important. And we actually think that it would be great if you adopted some sort of rule that if you are going to meet with one side of things, that you will meet with the other side if asked, because often we have a hard time getting through to some of you as well. So we can't stress enough the importance of this issue, and we hope you will continue to have further discussions on the matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanscom. The next speaker is Mark Massaro.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners. Mark Massaro, Sierra Club Coastal Programs. As you know all too well, ex parte communications, while it might not seem that way when you first join the commission, become an enormous amount of work for you. In fact, I'm sure that there are occasions when you have to spend as much time in ex parte communications in the course of a month as you have to spend in the actual meetings. And while those commission ex parte communications can be important, and Sierra Club has certainly wants to thank you for all of the time that you provide for us, it has also resulted in an image problem for this commission. For years, your good work has suffered from the perception that paid lobbyists enjoy far too much influence over these proceedings and coastal developments in general. If anything, that perception has grown by orders of magnitude as multi-million dollar paid lobbying efforts and expenditures have attached themselves to virtually every project in recent years, every major project in recent years, not just the Diablo Canyon situation, but the Dana Point Headlands, the Bolsa Chica Wetlands, the LNG, the toll roads, the desalination facilities, and on and on and on, where in past years, you had one paid lobbyist working for one project. Now you generally have an army of paid lobbyists working for each major project. We've tried to help. We worked furiously in 2005 with Assemblywoman Lori Saldana on AB 771, a comprehensive rescue measure regarding ex parte communications for this commission that managed to pass the legislature, both houses. It would have improved matters considerably, but Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed that legislation. It's clear that we can't pass this legislation over the objections of both the paid lobbyists and the administration. We need your help, and we need you to signal to the governor and to elected officials in Sacramento that you desire to improve these rules of the game. We're ready, and we stand for, here ready to help you in that effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Catherine Slater Carter.
Good morning, Catherine Slater Carter. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. I'm speaking first on behalf of ORCA, the Organization of Regional Coastal Activists. We had a discussion about ex parte communications, and it was noted that it's very difficult for the public to reach or to see the filings. You have to go into an office and bother staff, and so the suggestion that came out of our discussion was it would be very nice if these things were, if the ex parte communications were available online so that people could read them and see them without having to go into the office. It makes very much sense to make them accessible to all of the public and the lobbyists in that regard. It would also make it easier. And I would now like to speak as an individual who had a permit before the Coastal Commission last month, and indeed some of the discussion left us surprised at some of the questions and issues that were raised about our permit. We were unaware of what had been said by somebody who had concerns about our public works plan, and in fact had we had a little bit more time to and knowledge of what issues had been raised, we would have been more prepared to respond to them. So it would be very helpful to have these things available online, because now with iTouch and all these online communication devices, people could actually access them on the day of the meeting and be able to read them for themselves. So I thank you very much for your time and consideration.
That's the end of our speakers. The commission have questions? Staff? Commissioner Schellenberger?
I have a few questions of staff. One is that I have chosen, maybe wrongfully, but not to put my address on the webpage. And so it has happened in the past that, say, a large document is sent to commissioners at the last minute, a day or two before the meeting. Since my mail goes to the Coastal Commission office, we had this just a few months ago, there was not time for staff to turn around and get it in my hands before I came to the meeting. So this is awkward. I end up sometimes without the written information that's been sent as an ex parte to all of the commissioners. And so my question to staff is, what is the status of that? I've always been hesitant to say that at the time on the public record because I was afraid it could disqualify me from voting or participating in an issue. So is my question clear?
Well, I'm not sure, but in terms of getting information, normally, the input we get is sent directly to your address.
What did you say, that I should have that?
That you probably should use an address that you can access more rapidly than through the commission, because, as you note, if we get it late, we often don't have time to get it to you.
So you're saying the onus is on the commissioner to be sure that they're available.
That their address, that where they can access the mail in a timely fashion, is.
Have you ever driven through Clements, California?
Pardon me?
Yes, I've been. I don't get my mail in a timely manner like you all. I don't have a postman. But anyway, it is a question of who has the onus of, do I have to be available to pick up my mail in time? Or is it the project applicant who is trying to communicate with me?
My thought would be that it would be a shared responsibility. They have to make an effort to make sure, if they're sending it to commissioners, that they take steps to get it to you. On the other hand, you also, I think, need to have an address that they can access that you will be able to get to in a timely fashion. So,
which is to say, I have a greater responsibility to take written ex parte than I do verbal.
Well, I don't know.
Written
materials are not ex partes. Written materials are available to everybody. They become part of the record. They're online. Those are things that everybody has equal access to. An ex parte is a communication with you that other interested persons, by definition, are not present at. But written material, everyone can see once it becomes part of the record.
I think there are two issues there. One is that there's some information that you don't have available to you in a timely fashion in order to make the decision because of the nature of, you know, where you live and the mailing issue. But that is not to be confused with an ex parte communication, which is a different set of issues.
Okay, and sorry.
Just to add to that, there is often material both from commission staff. Commission staff sometimes receives material from an applicant late and responds to it very close to the hearing, and the same is true of written information from the applicant. So it is often the case, as you know, that there are addendums both from the applicant and or from staff that come in very close to or at the hearing. So in some sense, it's hard to make a distinction between if something arrives at commission headquarters so late that we cannot get it to you ahead of the meeting. But oftentimes, applicants actually do just bring things to the hearing, so there isn't time to read it ahead of time for anyone.
Right. Well, that's really a separate issue, but it's not an ex parte issue. And so then my next...
And if I could just... add one other thing. As long as you have the materials in advance of the hearing, when you talk about there being a burden on you, it certainly, as a practical matter, may be much more difficult for you to review those materials if you're getting them in very close to the time of the hearing. But there's no recusal requirement or other obligation on your part not to participate just because you got it in close in time to the hearing. As long as you get it, you still have the ability to participate in the hearing.
Okay, thank you. And then my other observation is, as somebody who often doesn't take ex parte, is that it's become kind of common practice to go around the room and for commissioners to say, I talked with so-and-so at such and such a time about the issue of the staircase, the issue of the, which actually for me doesn't impart any information. And I think what I'm hearing from our counsel is that actually is would not be considered full disclosure. So my request would be of our staff, and particularly of our counsel, that to be a little more proactive about asking commissioners to fully disclose when, in your opinion, it's not. I think it's difficult for me, to be honest, as a commissioner, to say to other commissioners, could you be more explicit about what actually happened? But since our legal counsel's job a lot of times is to keep us out of trouble, it strikes me that that would be a helpful way of keeping us out of trouble and going forward.
Thank you. Commissioner Blank?
I think Commissioner Clark was next.
We're first.
Oh, okay.
Actually, so the commission knows there are four other people that have lined up.
Thank you, though, Steve. I appreciate that.
I just want to make some generic comments. First, I just want to note that ex parte is part of the Coastal Act. It's specifically referenced in 30324, as our staff counsel pointed out. I personally just kind of wouldn't know how to operate without hearing all sides of an issue. I think our staff does a spectacular job, but I think, like everything, we have to educate between our staff's recommendation, what the applicant says, and what their opponents have to say. And for me personally, I cannot imagine doing that in a vacuum. And so I am a big supporter of continuing ex parte. I'm also a big supporter of having the rules as crystal clear as necessary and as explicit as necessary, and if we need to do other things to make the public have access to that. I think I heard a spectacularly smart and simple suggestion of making all the ex partes part of the same public record we make the staff reports. That is, maybe I could just ask staff, why can't we post the ex parte as we get them?
Well, one of the problems is that the timing. When we get ex parte disclosures in a timely fashion before the mailing, they can be attached, and they are. It's those that come in afterward that we don't have the time to put online or attached to the reports.
So, Director Douglas, just to continue, can we just have a hard copy of those outside for the public, for the ones that didn't make it in the staff report, so everybody has full access? I just thought it was an interesting comment.
Yeah, we do include them in the addendum that we hand out at the commission meetings.
But they're available to us. Are those available to the public outside the table?
Yes, they are.
Okay. That's about it. I just wanted to say, again, I have found ex parte incredibly useful, and again, from both sides of, you know, I hear this as only developers do ex parte, but in fact, I've spent an enormous amount of time with my friends in the environmental community, Mr. Massara, Susan Jordan, everybody else. When there's an issue of concern, they work equally hard and sometimes even harder than the paid representatives who are also working hard to represent their clients. And just personally, I'm a big supporter of the process.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Meltzer, did you want to comment?
I did just want to respond to one thing that Commissioner Blank said about operating in a vacuum. The purpose of the public hearing is for all of the information that the commission is acting on to be presented, and we have public comment and opportunity for each side and interested persons to speak and present their views. And of course, as Mr. Helperin pointed out, many boards and commissions do not allow ex partes. So while there is a specific authorization for ex partes, and we do understand that many commissioners find them useful and helpful, the idea that in the absence of them there would be a vacuum, we hope is not the case, because the purpose of the public hearing is to provide substantive information for the entire public to hear and understand what is occurring.
So, again, to staff counsel, I just want to point out that at the public hearing we have very limited time for both applicants and their opponents, either 3 minutes or 15 minutes. And for complex issues that have taken years to wend its way through the commission process or months or days, I just think giving the public the ability to have an extended conversation with commissioners, and whether they choose to take that opportunity or not is up to them. And as I said, the rules which we set on how to take that, I think we need to be as explicit as possible, but believing that 3 or 15 minutes is sufficient to give an applicant the ability to feel that they were heard, even if we do believe 3 or 15 minutes is enough. If they don't believe 3 or 15 minutes is enough, then since we're public servants, I'm happy to meet with anybody, anytime, anywhere, and just listen. And I've listened to a lot of stuff that could have been done in 3 minutes, but it truly, of someone facing a commission and a process and a quasi-judicial body where they are feeling they're being judged and not feeling they have enough time to be heard, I personally think it's our duty to do that. But as I said, I appreciate other commissioners' ability on, or judgment on whether they decide to take it or not. I just wanted to share why I do and my thinking process in that. So thank you, Council.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Clark?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I absolutely 100% agree with Commissioner Blank. I couldn't have said it better. If he had not said it, I would have said exactly what he just said. And I carve time out every month because I do get contacted, as most commissioners do, both by applicants and by opponents. Of the last year and a half, on a monthly basis, I typically get contacted by ORCA and the Sierra Club. Meet with them, or whether it's conference call or in person, and I think Steve said it absolutely correctly, and I totally agree.
Thank you. Commissioner Wan?
Yeah. Okay, I'm on now. I wanted to go to two things. First of all, on the ex parte, I did have a question. If I am talking to an interested party, but that I am having that discussion in the presence of a staff member, does that constitute ex parte communications?
I'm sorry, is the question that you are discussing a matter with a staff member or in
no,
addition?
I'm basically discussing it. It may be with a staff member as well, but I'm basically discussing it with, say, an interested party wants to talk to me, but the a staff member is present at the same time.
Yes.
Does that constitute ex-party communications?
Yes, it does.
That still constitutes. Okay.
Yes, it does.
All right. Then the other thing gets to a comment that Commissioner Schallenberger made, which Mr. Douglas responded to, and I also have had the problem, it's not ex parte, of, because my address on the web is the commission's address, of having things that are sent to me, sent to the commission, and it takes a while for it to get to back to me. The comment about the address, the reason I do not post my address on our website is because initially when I did, it wound up on Google Earth as commission office with my address pointing to my house. And to this day, Google still has my home phone number as a result of all of that listed as a commission office. And periodically I get calls and I have not been able to get them to take it off. So that is a serious problem. If it were not for that, I would list, as I used to, I would list my address and phone number on the web. That I can't do that because of the complications. I see Jamie Patterson frowning, but I'm telling you, that's what happened. I used to have it listed, and then when Google Earth came on board, they listed my house.
You say you asked them to remove it, and they did not, because they did that to me, and I asked them to remove it, and it's off. They took it off.
My address is off, but my phone number is still listed in their phone directory.
You can have the, you can ask them to remove that as well.
I have. Hopefully, you can tell me how to do that because I've tried.
Why don't you see me after the or during the break?
All right. Thank you, Vice Chair Burke.
Problems with all this and. Question that Commissioner Schaub. Is it on now? Okay. The question that Commissioner Schallenberger asked was taken fairly superficially because the answer, if the question was asked, if a communication was sent to Commissioner Schallenberger, which was not sent to other commissioners, how would that affect the ex parte if it was not passed on or was passed on to her? I don't, you know, I'm not clear on that.
Did you have a question for the staff?
If a communication is sent to one individual commissioner and not to staff and not to the other commissioners, then it is an ex parte communication. And if it's sent to all of the commissioners and submitted to staff to be placed in the record, then it's not. But I believe Commissioner Schallenberger's concern was more independent of whether it was sent to her alone or to everyone. The concern was more of how she gets any communications that are sent, whether to her or to everyone, in time to be prepared for the meeting, unless I'm mistaken.
Well, let me tell you, I've, in my past 6 or 8 years being here, have seen people on breaks and at meals and in traveling through hotels approached by the public and reps of various projects and having comments made to them, almost yelled to them when walking by. Now, from what you say, we're responsible for articulating that in an ex parte in detail. I'm just not clear on how a human being does that. Really. I mean, I understand the philosophic, and I understand how you can want that, but how do they really do that?
Beth?
Well, the requirement would be that if someone says something to you substantive, that you make a quick note of it, that you've been informed of that, and that you pass that along. And indeed, if someone says something substantive to you that makes you think, well, this, you know, that changes my thinking about a project, it is important that people be aware of that so that the other side can be represented.
So the key thing is substantive or mind-changing?
No, the key thing is any communication. However, if somebody just says to you, vote for X, there's obviously...
It's never that simple.
Exactly.
It's never that simple.
Exactly. At the same time, it often is the case, and you've been here for these types of ex parte disclosures, where at breaks or at breakfast, interested persons approach commissioners, and during the ex parte disclosure portion of the hearing, commissioners say, during the break, this person came up to me. So you do the very best you can.
I understand what you're saying. I don't think that that's possible, but I'm going to try to do that to the best of my ability. Now, there are commissioners who talk casually in social conversations to people of interested groups about issues coming before the commission. Now, I know that for a fact. I've never heard one of those divulged in an ex parte in 6 years.
Okay, thank you.
If there is an application pending, it is something that the commissioners should be disclosing.
Okay. Well, when I came here, I was just like Commissioner Clark and Commissioner Blank. And my door was wide open to anybody who wanted to come in and sit down and talk. But as the reporting requirements become more onerous, I have to feel that I'm going like Commissioner Schallenberger. I'm going to grind it down now unless it's really something that's so complex that I don't think that I have a full understanding by reading the material, then what these requirements are going to do is stop me from taking ex partes. That's just a personal opinion.
Right, thank you. Commissioner Riley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, what I come away with a value from today, I think, is really two things. One is that the focus really is on full disclosure when you take ex partes, and also to avoid ex partes on matters involving or related to enforcement issues. I think those are the main things that we need to be cognizant of. Mr. Massara's comments that, you know, somehow those of us that take ex partes have tarnished the image of the commission, you know, I would take some exception to. I think as Commissioner Blank and Clark have articulated that there's a value to for those of us who choose to engage in ex partes and particularly across the board, not just with one side or another. In my own case, I know with the substantial volume of both hearings and materials that we get on a monthly basis, it's helpful to me to know what the one or two issues are between an applicant and staff. So when I look at the staff report and the record, I can focus in on those things pretty quickly. And in a 150-page staff report, that's helpful to me. So if I know what the issues of contention are going to be, I'm able to take a look at that and see what staff rationale is, see what the applicants say, and probably come better informed to the commission hearing than I would be otherwise. So there's some practical reasons why I think, you know, some of those practices are there. But as Commissioner Blank pointed out, legislature put ex partes specifically in the Coastal Act for a reason. I think that they intended for us to be available to the public more than just at hearings, and I think the reporting requirements are also in there to provide transparency for any of those communications that do occur. I think the system works. I'm not particularly an advocate for changing it, and I think it served us well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, that's the last commissioner speaker. Anyone else? Then we'll bring it back to staff. Did you have any closing remarks? None? That concludes our workshop then.
Yes, Madam Chair, and before we go on and before I forget, we're going to hand deliver to you at your hotel some background, kind of an outline report of a brief overview of what your staff has been working on relative to climate change issues. So please look for that when you get to the hotel. You don't need to read the whole thing, but just kind of skim it, be aware of it, take it with you, and we'll have a brief report on that tomorrow. And Susan will give that report, and she'll also give you the budget report tomorrow. I thought she was going to be able to do it today, but because of the federal evaluation that's ongoing in our office today, she's there with them, and she'll be here tomorrow. So with that, Jack, do you want to move the agenda?
Yes, that moves us on to item number 4, and these are the consent permits for the Los Angeles County portion of the South Coast District. Staff is not aware of any opposition to the permit applications on the consent calendar and recommends the commission vote and approve the consent calendar.
All right, thank you. Do we have any ex parte communication? See none. What's the pleasure of the commission?
Move consent.
Moved and seconded that we approve the consent calendar. We had one speaker slip from a Mr. Gatto, but you're just here for questions only. All right, thank you. We have a motion and a second to approve the consent calendar. All those in favor, is there any objection to unanimous roll call vote on the consent calendar? Seeing none, the consent calendar is approved.
Moves us on to item number 5, and these are the administrative permits for the Orange County portion of the South Coast District, and staff is not aware of any opposition to the one administrative permit and recommends the commission concur with the executive director's determination that this item qualifies for issuance as an administrative permit.
Do we have any objections to concurrence with this matter? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
Moving on to item number 6 is the consent calendar permits for the Orange County portion of the South Coast District. And again, staff is not aware of any opposition to the permit applications on the consent calendar. Recommends the commission vote and approve the consent calendar.
We have no speakers on this item.
Move consent.
There's a motion by Commissioner Clark, a second by Commissioner Hueso to approve the consent calendar. Are there any objections to unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the consent calendar is approved.
Item number 7 is the Deputy Director's Report for the South Central Coast District, which is a list of the waivers, immaterial amendments, and immaterial extensions for the district. Staff did receive an objection to a one-year time extension for a three-unit apartment building on Coastline Drive in Malibu. This extension was actually reported to the Commission at the October Commission meeting. However, staff received an objection to the extension within a 10-day reporting period, which ended after the meeting. And pursuant to the Commission's regulation, the objection letter must be reported to the Commission. The objections cited in the letter do not relate to any changed circumstances that would affect the project's consistency with the Coastal Act. And in our view, the objections raised in the letter were thoroughly addressed by the Commission at the time the Commission acted and approved on this CDP. Therefore, the Executive Director has determined this objection does not raise a changed circumstance in this case. Staff is not aware of any other opposition to the items in the district director's report and recommends the commission concur with the executive director's determination on these matters.
All right. Is there any objection to concurrence? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
Next item is item 7A. The City of Carpinteria is requesting an amendment to the implementing ordinance of its certified LCP to include a procedure requiring a conditional use permit with special findings for granting of a permit to any retail use greater than 20,000 gross square feet. The proposed ordinance is a revision. The proposed ordinance revision is consistent with the certified land use plan and does not constitute a change in the kinds, location, or intensity of use. The executive director has determined that the amendment is minor, and staff recommends commission concurrence on this LCP amendment.
Any objections to concurrence from the commission? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
Moving on to item 7B is a certification review for Channel Islands Public Works Plan Amendment 1-07 for waterside improvements at the harbor. Ventura County has formally agreed to accept the commission's suggested modifications to the LCP amendment, and staff recommends the commission concur with the executive director's determination that their actions are legally adequate and this amendment can be effectively certified.
Any objections from the commission to concurrence? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
Item number 8 are the permit items staff is recommending be moved to the consent calendar. Staff is recommending two regular calendar items be moved to the consent calendar, and those are item 10B, the Sandrin application, and item 10C, the Hallbricht application. There is an addendum to item 10C to make a minor clarification to the ESHA findings, and there's also an addendum letter supporting item 10C, the Hallbricht application. And staff is recommending the commission vote and approve these items.
Move consent.
Second. Moved and seconded that we approve the consent calendar. Any objections to unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the consent calendar is approved.
Next item is item 9A, and this is a request for an extension of time to consider the City of Santa Barbara's local coastal program amendment 2-08. The city is proposing to amend its LCP to apply land use and zoning designations to a parcel intended to be annexed into the City of Santa Barbara and modify the land use and zoning designations on an adjacent parcel and to create a new zone district to establish development standards for the Veronica Meadows specific plan. The Coastal Act does provide for the commission to extend its time limit for action on LCP amendment for up to 1 year. And due to workload and staffing constraints, staff is requesting an extension to the 90-day time limit to act on the LCP amendment not to exceed 1 year. The motion to extend the time limit is found at the bottom of the one-page staff report, and this concludes staff's presentation on this item.
We have no speakers on this item. Commissioner Hueso?
I move that the commission extend the 90-day time limit to act on the City of Santa Barbara LCP amendment number SBC-MAJ-2-08 for 1 year. Recommend a yes vote.
Second.
We have a motion by Commissioner Hueso and a second by Commissioner Potter to extend the time limit. Any objections to unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, time extension is granted.
Next item up is item 10D, and I have a PowerPoint, but it's got to be downloaded. I forgot to give this to the staff over there. So Alex has the PowerPoint. If you could download that really quickly, please. And it's the item 10D, the Tercios application. All right, thank you. Again, this is item 10D, and the applicant is Jose Tercios. The applicant is proposing a two-story, 35-foot-high, 4,759-square-foot single-family residence with an 822-square-foot attached garage, a pool, a septic system, and a construction of an extension of an access road with 6,350 cubic yards of grading. The applicant is also proposing to restore an unpermitted road that was used for geologic testing. The subject property is a 13-acre vacant parcel located approximately 2,000 feet south of Mulholland Highway and about 2,000 feet west of Cold Canyon Road in the Santa Monica Mountains of unincorporated Los Angeles County, as can be seen on this slide here. The existing paved road known as Mallee View Drive provides access to the property from Mulholland Highway. The paved road terminates approximately 100 feet north of the applicant's north property boundary, and the applicant is proposing to extend this access road approximately 100 feet to the south to the proposed development area in the northwest corner of the property, as can be seen on this little site plan here. Staff is recommending approval of the permit application, subject to 15 special conditions outlined in the staff report. Staff has received correspondence from interested parties, including a petition indicating that an informal trail on the subject property that connects with the Cold Creek Trail located to the south will be blocked by the proposed development. The Cold Creek Trail is a LUP designated trail, and that's to the south. And here on this slide, this is the trail in question right here that runs through the applicant's property. This connector trail on this property was constructed sometime between 1994 and 2001 without the benefit of a coastal development permit. There's no substantial evidence has been provided that would demonstrate implied dedication over this trail. In addition, there's an alternative trail route to Coal Canyon Creek Trail that traverses a neighboring property where the commission secured a trail easement over this trail through a CDP issued on a property in north in 1981, and that is this trail here located just to the west, and it curves around and comes back down. In your addendum, there is a letter from the Santa Monica Mountains Trails Council pointing out that there's another connector trail segment that traverses the southern portion of the property, and that is located down here. It cuts across the corner of the applicant's property to the south. And this is the trail that the commission required a trail easement over on the northern portion of that connector trail in 1901. The proposed development will not affect this trail segment in any way and will not interfere with any prescriptive rights that may exist over this trail. The trail is within the required conservation easement area of the property, and staff has recommended commission to limit fencing so there won't be any blockage of the trail in the future. Therefore, in staff's opinion, there's really no basis to require an offer to dedicate a trail easement in this case. However, the applicant has indicated to me this morning that he is willing to offer to dedicate a 20-foot wide trail easement across that lower portion of the property to accommodate that trail. And this would be implemented through a new condition requiring a 20-foot wide easement. This would be a direct dedication to the Mountains Recreation and Conservation Authority. The applicant include an exhibit showing the trail. However, he is not willing to do a surveyed meets and bounds description as we usually require because of the cost of that. So that would be a brand new condition on the permit. Another issue addressed in several letters, which are part of your addendum packet, relate to the visual impact of the development, particularly from public viewpoints to the south of the property. One of the letters suggests that reducing the height of the residence by 5 feet would minimize the visibility of the residence. And on this slide here, we can see this is the view of the residence from location from Mulholland Highway, which is located to the north, and this is the previously approved structure approved by the commission in 1981, and the new structure will extend approximately 3 feet above this little ridge line here. Staff did investigate the visibility of the residents from public view areas from the south carefully, including Cold Canyon Road and Cold Canyon Creek Trail. The residence is visible from various portions of Cold Canyon Road and Cold Creek Trail to the south. The residence is situated approximately 15 feet south of the residence that was approved by the commission and about 100 feet down slope where the commission had of this other residence. approved development to the north has not been constructed, but the permit has been exercised through the construction of a building pad. The residence approved on this site was a two-story residence about 32 feet high, somewhere in that range. And given the location of the proposed residence below the ridge line, and given the distance from Cold Canyon Road and Cold Canyon Creek Trail, reducing the height of the residence, in our view, would not significantly reduce the visual impacts of the residence as seen from these public viewpoints, and given that the commission had approved a two-story house above this one. Staff did consider other siting alternatives for the residence and designs, and to reduce grading and minimize impacts of the development. The applicant originally proposed the structure to construct the residence 200 feet south of the 200 feet south of the current proposal, which would have required extension of the access road out 200 feet in length, and would have required over 10,000 cubic yards of grading. And in response to staff concerns regarding the amount of grading and landform alteration, as well as adverse impacts of chaparral escha, the applicant revised the project. The revised project location is clustered near the development approved by the commission in 1981. And he's reduced the overall grading, the length of the access road, and this has minimized the removal of chaparral. Fortunately, the revised building site is somewhat more visible than the applicant's original proposal. However, again, staff does not believe the proposed residence will result in a significant impact as seen from public view areas from either the north or the south. However, I must acknowledge that staff did struggle with this decision a bit, and on whether or not to lower the house. But given there was an approved residence just to the north, and the distance from these trails and public viewpoints, we really didn't think it was presented a significant visual impact. However, staff is recommending several conditions to minimize the visual impact of the development, including landscape screening, structure colors that are compatible with the surrounding landscape, and a night lighting condition to maintain the rural character of the area and the dark skies at night. There's another letter in your addendum packet questioning the legitimacy of the applicant's easement rights over the access road to the subject property. In addition, we received a late letter from the Angel Law Firm addressing this same issue. The applicant has submitted evidence that he has easement rights over the road, and the neighboring property owner disputes this claim and asserts that the applicant does not have easement rights over the road. In our view, this is a civil matter that will most likely be resolved. And in any event, the road easement issue is really not a Coastal Act issue. And finally, several letters from neighboring property owners assert that they did not receive a hearing notice for this application. Notice was sent to property owners within 100 feet of the property as required pursuant to the commission regulations. The persons that are asserting that they did not receive notice, their properties are outside that 100-foot notice area. And again, staff is recommending approval of the permit application, and the motion for approval can be found on page 2 of the staff report, and this concludes staff's presentation.
All right, thank you, staff. Let's go to the commission for ex parte communication. Seeing any, then we have two speakers on this matter.
Madam Chair, I actually, now that I think about it, I did have a brief conversation yesterday with Don Schmitz regarding this matter, at which time he expressed his concurrence with the staff recommendations and also mentioned the possibility of the trail dedication.
Thank you, Commissioner Potter. And then with regard to the speakers, Mr. Schmitz, how much time do you need?
Is there any speaker slips in opposition?
I have a speaker slip, but it doesn't indicate what the position is.
Well, I doubt they're here to support us, Madam Chair, so unfortunately I would request 15 minutes, and I'd like to retain 3 minutes of that for rebuttal time, please.
All right, thank you. We'll give you that time then, 12 minutes now and 3 minutes for rebuttal. And you could put your name on the record, too.
Yes, ma'am. My name is Don Schmitz, representing the applicant, Jose Tercios. I'd like to thank staff for their presentation. I'd also like to figure out how to work the PowerPoint presentation clicker here. Hopefully before we run the clock. Says on. Laser pointer is working. The suspense is killing us. All right, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Don Schmitz representing the applicant. Staff has already presented to you the location of the property located south of Mulholland and west of Coal Canyon Road. You can see on the USGS quadrangle slide in front of you that the development site has been located as far as possible from the USGS blue line streams adjacent to the property. The property is located in an area of rambling estate homes. The original development scenario has been significantly reduced as we interacted with staff, and they made helpful suggestions in regards to what would garner their support. We have reduced the amount of grading. We reduced the off-site access from 20 foot to 15 foot with the fire department concurrence. Reducing the grading significantly, but most importantly, we relocated the building site, as you can see in the slide in front of you. This shortened the driveway by some 380 foot. This reduced the impermeable area, and very important to staff, this also increased the overlapping fuel modification with the previously approved project from 1981. We also redesigned the pad to step down the pool area to further reduce grading, which was something that came from the South Coast office staff. So what this has done is reduced the grading by close to 5,000 cubic yards from the original design. It's reduced the amount of impermeable lot coverage. It has reduced the size of the development area from that which was approved by the County of Los Angeles. It has reduced significantly the amount of vegetation removal and fuel modification. And the overlapping fuel modification from the previously approved project has been more than doubled. This is reflected in the staff findings that the project design is before you today is what is most protective of the ESHA resources in the area. What about the surrounding development? You do have some objection letters. Frankly, I think that they're a little off base. When you take a look at the precedent of what's in the area, there's a 6,500 square foot. These are all Coastal Commission approved projects, by the way. House up on Mulholland Highway, 7,500 square foot, 22,000 square foot, the Trey Trust. We're proposing 4,700 square foot. You can see that over 5,000 square foot, was approved by the Coastal Commission in the 1981 permit directly to the north of the instant application before you today. Along Coal Canyon, there's a fairly recently approved project of 4,800 square foot, again, larger than what is before you today. So you can see just on this listing in front of you that we are well within the precedent that has been established by the Commission in regards to what is appropriate for the area. What about grading? Just to the northwest of us, the Commission approved a house in 02 with 16,000 cubic yards of grading. Almost immediately adjacent to us, there was 10,000 cubic yards of grading at 25730 Mulholland Highway. That was the Anselmo project. Immediately to the north of us, there was 5,500 cubic yards of grading approved by the Commission. It just goes on. Let's just get to the table. Brevity is best. You can see that in the surrounding area, we are on the lower end of the scale from what the Commission has permitted for amount of landform alteration within this canyon. Visual resources. The proposed house is almost 2,000 feet from Mulholland Highway to the north and 1,300 feet from Coal Creek Trail. And again, 1,700 feet from Coal Canyon Road. We note with some interest that the objection letter in regards to visual impacts from the height of the house It was written by the Goldens, and they're located at 1101 Coal Canyon. They're about 150 feet from Coal Creek Trail and about 380 foot from Coal Canyon Road. We're going to be much more distant than them. This is their house. You can see this is a house which is, for all intents and purposes, quite commensurate, a little bit bigger in footprint, I think, than what we're proposing, and they're located in immediate vicinity. Our house will be located behind this ridge line. I don't think that visual impacts would be significant from what it is that we are proposing. It has been thoroughly analyzed by staff. Again, this is our neighbors that objected in regards to visual impacts to the trail. You can see they're located immediately above Coal Creek Trail. This is reflected in the staff report that specifies it as it pertains to visual impacts that the application that is before you today is in fact consistent with Section 30251 of the Coastal Act. The issue of trails is something which is raised a number of times in the objection letters before you today. And as you can see, the subject property is not crossed in any way by any mapped trails on the National Park Service maps, nor in the 1986 Santa Monica Mountains Malibu Land Use Plan, which is the guiding planning document that the Commission adopted. There are no mapped trails across the subject property as well. So the issue that is before you today as it pertains to trails is one for trails that were aspired to by trails advocates in the area for some so-called private trails. It is true that there was a dedication required by the Commission in 1981 for the project immediately to the north of us. And this is the alignment that Mr. Ainsworth was referring to, what would be a envisioned north-south connector for a private trail. I think they're calling it the Hidden Canyon Trail, which is located to the west of the subject property. The Coal Creek Trail, the mapped trail adopted by the Commission in the County of Los Angeles, is located to the south, as you can see on the exhibit. However, the privately proposed trail does go across the southwestern corner of my client's property. As has been stated by staff, there is not a legal basis for an exaction of this trail. That being said, I don't think it has any deleterious impacts to my client's use and enjoyment of the property. I received a phone call from a friend of mine, Ruth Gerson, who is the president of the Recreation and Equestrian Coalition. She pleaded with me to do this dedication, as did staff. And so I think it's a very reasonable thing to do. Therefore, we have submitted the exhibit, which has been handed out to you. This would be a new special condition whereupon we would dedicate, I believe staff asked for, a 20-foot-wide dedication, which roughly follows the alignment you can see in the exhibit located right here. And so I am reading that into the record. I'm volunteering that as a component of the application before you today. So in conclusion, which I know you're always glad to hear me say, we do request that the Commission approve the project, follow the recommendation of staff. The project has been designed to more than exceed the required setbacks from the Blue Line streams on the adjacent property. It is what is most protective of Esha and the Esha habitat in the areas identified in the staff report because of the overlapping fuel modification. The grading has been cut in half and is well below the precedent established by the Commission for projects in the area, and again, I've already addressed the issue as it pertains to Esha. So with that, brevity is best. I'll conclude for now and retain the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next speaker is Meredith Lobel.
Can you hear me? I have a PowerPoint, and I don't know whether they're able to put it on.
Could you help the speaker with her PowerPoint?
Look for the most recent PowerPoint document. It'll be it. But, you know, I can actually probably cut to the chase.
Okay, well, first we need your name for the record and how much time you'd like.
Meredith Lobel Angel, Angel Law, representing Dr. Jeffrey Lithau. I don't think I'm going to use 5 minutes. I'm asking for 5 minutes. I think it's going to be less.
We'll give you 5 minutes, eh?
Okay, thank you. First of all, using the time while he's setting up. Okay. Oh, how exciting. Okay, great. You know, I'm focusing on three issues. First one is I do want to thank Don Schmitz for the public trail dedication. Dr. Jeffrey Lithau was interested in this issue. It wasn't his primary issue. We appreciate applicants' amenability to do that. The second issue I wanted to deal with is notice. It's a wider issue than Dr. Lithau's. We often represent parties in the Santa Monicas that are calling staff and saying they want to be notified. Staff is under a great deal of pressure given budget cuts, and I'm thinking that I want to place it in the record that when we do know that expediters often represent parties in the Santa Monica Mountains, I'm going to urge such individuals and groups to contact the expediter so that these people can be included as number five, getting stamped addressed envelopes as persons who are interested in such projects so that they don't have these notice issues come up and say it's last minute. Better just add them to that list and give them the notice. My main issue today for Dr. Lithau has to do with that easement. We were urging you to postpone a decision. It doesn't sound like that's a realistic expectation. As a result, what I would be interested in having you do is making that approval conditioned upon the provision of valid easement rights. There is an existing easement known as the Calder Settlement Easement. It's off of Cold Canyon. There's no dispute about access over that area. But what that's going to do is if that's the way the easement has to go, then you are going to be having a reviewed staff, you're going to have a renewed staff report with revisions about what that means to have a road come in there. Our position is on the title, in the chain of title, in all the title reports, there's no indication of easement rights down this so-called Mallee View Drive, which is actually a public utilities easement. Rabbani and Lithau both turned Satterley down. Satterley is related to Tercios in his request for easement rights through Mallee View. We do not have any problem with applicant coming through the Cold Canyon access. No question about the validity. So we're urging you today to make any approval conditioned upon valid easement rights being documented and given to you so that this can proceed properly. And really, I think that I can dispense with probably the rest of the PowerPoint. It's not that crucial that you read it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We'll go back to Mr. Schmitz for rebuttal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioners, again, Don Schmitz for the record, representing the applicant, Jose Tercios. We would be vehemently opposed to the suggestion that the commission should be inserted into any sort of civil dispute between us and our neighbors in regards to the validity of our access easements. As staff has already stated on the record, this is a civil matter between civil parties, and I think that would be inappropriate. The basis of review is, of course, the Coastal Act. It is the stated position of our clients that they have insured access. They've had their attorneys take a look at it. They believe that they do have access down Mallee View Drive, which was improved pursuant to that 1981 permit that the Coastal Commission gave to the neighbor immediately to the north. Therefore, it's although it may be an issue of some concern for our neighbors, it is not a Coastal Act issue. In regards to their thanking us for the trail dedication, that's warmly received. I'm glad that we were able to obviate that as a potential sticking point in front of the commission here today. So with that, I think I've already addressed all the specific issues that could be of concern that were raised in the objection letters. I want to reiterate again that we are volunteering up the trail dedication across the southwestern corner of the property. And with that, I would conclude, and I'm available for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Schmitz. Let's go back to staff for response.
Yes, Madam Chair. This commission has, from time to time, faced similar situations where there's been a legal dispute with neighbors relative to certain rights, including rights of access via easements. We don't think that the commission ought to insert itself into that question. Clearly, if this evolves to the point where a court rules that there is no easement, then they'd have to come back for an amendment to get approval for a different road alignment or access way. But we just don't think it's appropriate for the commission to weigh in the manner that was suggested. I don't want our staff to be in the middle of adjudicating whether or not an easement is valid or not. So from our perspective, we don't want to recommend any changes in our recommendation.
Ms. Schmeltzer?
Thank you. Just in addition to what the executive director said, the commission's action as proposed by staff today in no way confers on the applicant any rights that the applicant doesn't already have. To the extent that there's a civil dispute between the applicant and the opponent, that the commission's action does not affect that, and the commission's action is not taking a position on that.
Thank you. Anything else from staff? Thank you. Commissioner Kruer, your first speak.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question of Mr. Schmitz here today, and it's in regard to Mr. Schmitz, something in the staff report that Mr. Ainsworth talked about, and you talked about your generous offer in the spirit of Christmas for this trail easement. And I just want to make sure that we're talking about an irrevocable easement.
That is correct.
Okay. That is correct. And then the question I have is, why would you object to having a survey so this easement doesn't come into dispute in the future? And the very issue that the people using the trail know where this trail in the southwest corner is, because it's going to affect you down the road. You're going to wish you did survey it because of any title policy. If you go from a CLTA to an American ALTA or anything else, I'm surprised that you wouldn't want to spend $1,500 to survey it, because you and I could talk about it and you could run up more costs just representing that. So I'm surprised that you wouldn't want to agree to a survey. Would you agree to a survey?
No, sir. It's a good question. Commissioner Kruer, through the chair, these are tough times. These are belt-tightening times. And when I approached my client, the initial reaction in regards to the trail dedication was not favorable. And I groveled, because I knew that the hearing today, there would be a number of commissioners that would be looking at me and really wanting to see this trail easement dedication. However, this is not one of the bigger dollar clients, in all candor, and he asked what it would cost, and I told him probably not a whole lot, except for the meets and bounds description and doing the survey work on that. Then I approached Mr. Ainsworth and said, listen, this is the way that we used to do it fairly routinely back in the day, and I'm not talking about when we were cutting and pasting staff reports, but we used to draw an exhibit. It would be in the back of the staff report. And the fact that this is following an alignment of an old trail, ostensibly that the neighbors cut across here, that it's so far removed from the house, and that we've got a delineation here. I mean, this is hundreds and hundreds of feet away from the house in the bottom of the canyon. I don't feel like there's any concern that we will have that in any way, shape, or form this dedication will impinge upon their development rights should it be a couple feet in either direction. So we're offering it up, but we would like to utilize the exhibit that we gave you today.
I'm just suggesting a very good business idea, because if you have a floating easement and you try to describe it and there's an injury or a problem and they come back and there's some people asking for indemnification or sue you, you're going to have this floating easement, so it probably happened on your trail.
Well, I appreciate you bringing up that point, because I should read that into the record. The standard verbiage for this is that this trail dedication will be accepted by a public or quasi-public agency that will accept the maintenance of the trail and all assumption of risk of the trail. There will be absolutely no liability that will be conferred onto my clients for the dedication of this trail. This will be for the public.
Well, why would they accept something they don't even know where it is? You're unwilling to survey it. I appreciate the dedication, but I think you're making a very bad judgment, your client is, in this regard, to protect themselves, future title policies, future indemnity issues for future things, and you're going to face it sooner or later. I'm just suggesting to you, you do what you want, but it's unwise on your part.
Duly noted.
Thank you. Commissioner Juan?
Yes, these are questions really for staff, and it deals with a visual issue. I note that Mr. Schmitz showed us lots of big homes in the area, but the only ones that affect the view that we're talking about is that one home. But it was approved in 1981. So we looked at things very differently in 1981 than how we analyze things now. So I don't know if you look at that. At this home, we have to see whether it really creates an impact or not. And I think kind of independent of a home that was approved 27 years ago. My question for you was, am I correct when you were giving your explanation, you said that the home is visible about 3 feet above a ridgeline, is that correct?
Yes, it's 3 feet above that secondary ridgeline from Mulholland Highway.
Right.
From the north looking to the south.
So why wouldn't a 3 foot reduction in the house eliminate that view impact altogether?
Well, it would.
So then there would be a significant difference. It's not insignificant as to whether from a public scenic area you can see a house, even if it's only 3 foot of the feet of the house, or you can not see it at all.
Well, we were looking at it in the context of approved development in the area. And the approved development just to the north, there would be a large house right there on that pad. And that's
that
been approved and vested, so...
Is that a house you're talking about, the 1981
house?
That's
the 1981 house, right.
Right. So my concern is why we are allowing 1981 house to set the precedent for the area and allow continued and additional degradation of the view impacts.
Well, one of the things here clearly is that it's a judgment call. We made that judgment call, but I agree with you that it may not have been correct, and so we stand here ready for your guidance.
Yeah, it would seem to me that a 3 foot reduction to avoid any view impact at all, that whole area is, except for a scattered home, is very undeveloped, very rural, highly scenic, and I'd hate to think that by saying that the 1981 home sets a precedent, we now set the precedent that every single home there could create a view impact. And when we're talking about the reduction of 3 feet in height to eliminate it. So I'd like to listen what some of my other commissioners might have to say about that.
Thank you. Commissioner Clark?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I move that the Commission approve the Coastal Development Permit number 4-07-106 pursuant to the staff recommendation and recommend a yes vote.
We have a motion by Commissioner Clark and a second by Commissioner Riley. They're both recommending a yes vote. Passage of the motion will result in approval of the permit as condition and adoption to the findings in the staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion?
Just briefly, I think staff has covered this development permit correctly. In terms of Commissioner Wan's issue on height of the residence, I understand it, but I'm not sure that the precedent aspect overrides. I think the judgment call was correct by the staff on this, and I'm supporting staff recommendation.
Thank you. Commissioner Riley? Commissioner Schallenberger.
Yeah, I'd like to make an amending motion to add a special condition. I guess it's a special condition to reduce the height of the house by 3 feet.
We have an amending motion by Commissioner Schallenberger, second by Commissioner Wan, to reduce the height by 3 feet. Would you like to speak to your motion?
Yes, in the sense that I'd actually like to repeat what Commissioner Wan said earlier. It's not a question of precedent. The standard of review is the Coastal Act. The fact that there is an earlier, I understand that in a way it logically makes sense that this is not as tall as was once approved, but that's not our standard. Our standard here is the Coastal Act. It is a rural area, and it doesn't appear that a 3 feet reduction in height is any undue hardship on the homeowner or the home developer, so I would urge my commissioners a yes vote.
Mr. Wan?
I think I've said it all. I think that, as I said, the one home that's in the area should not serve as a precedent and require us to allow this to go on. There's going to be more homes in this area, and we need to be concerned about the impacts to the view from scenic areas and public trails.
Commissioner Riley?
Yeah, I just think that before we vote on this, we ought to at least hear from the applicant's representative on their reaction to this particular proposal.
Give your name for the record, please.
Yes, ma'am. Don Schmitz, representing the applicant. The commission is going to exercise its discretion, of course, but I would ask that you don't do this, and I think you're misinterpreting something. It's not about precedent, only in the sense that the project referred to by staff is a permitted project that's vested. It will be built, and all 32 feet of that house will be visible from the Mulholland Highway 2,000 feet away. The 3 feet of our house that is being deliberated upon today is all that will be seen. It will be seen right next to the vested home, which will be 32 feet in height. So the judgment call that was made by staff is a 3 foot next to a 32-foot tall home does not constitute a significant impact. And yes, the basis of review is the Coastal Act, and it's the same Coastal Act that was utilized and the findings were made by the commission to approve the home right next to us, all of it visible in 1981. So with that, we would urge you not to impose the new special condition, reducing it by 3 feet.
Thank you. Commissioner Kruer is first, and then Commissioner.
Just briefly, I don't think I can support the amending motion. It would be quite draconian to make this condition effective on this house. I mean, you're starting all over and talk about an economic impact in these times and having this project that's already been permitted. It would be quite punitive.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Blank?
I happen to agree with Commissioner Kruer, but I have a question for the applicant's agent. You mentioned the house was 32 feet high on Exhibit 7. The elevation shows it 35 feet high.
The 32 feet height I was referring to, Commissioner Blank, was for the neighboring house that was approved by the commission in 1981.
So you're asking for approval of Exhibit 7 as approved?
Yes,
for
sir.
35 feet in
yes,
height?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Potter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to side with Commissioner Kruer and Blank on this, and I'm doing that based on what staff alluded to earlier, which were special conditions that have been added. 4A6 speaks to landscaping for screening purposes. Special condition 5 talks about the structural appearances and how to mitigate the visual impacts. And this special condition number 6 talks about the use of appropriate lighting so that it does not glow in the night. So for that reason, I think it's appropriately conditioned.
All right, thank you, Commissioner Clark.
Yeah, I totally agree with Commissioner Potter. I think those mitigating factors contribute to the ability to approve as recommended.
All right. We have the clerk please call the roll on the amending motion.
Mr. Blank?
No.
Mr. Burke? Commissioner Clark?
No.
Mr. Wessel? Commissioner Kruer?
No.
Commissioner Potter? Commissioner Riley?
No.
Commissioner Schellenberger?
Yes.
Commissioner Wan?
Yes.
No.
2-8.
The vote is 2-8, and the amending motion fails. And with regard to the main motion, could you call the roll on that?
Commissioner Burke? Commissioner Clark?
Yes.
Commissioner Wessel?
Yes.
Brewer?
Yes.
Commissioner Potter? Commissioner Riley?
Yes.
Schellenberger?
Yes.
Commissioner Wan?
Yes.
Commissioner Blank?
Yes.
Chairman Neely?
Yes.
Unit.
The
vote is unanimous, and the commission hereby approves coastal development permit number 4-07-106 for the proposed development and adopts the findings set forth in the staff report. And we'll, I think we'll take a 10-minute break right now, and then we'll get back to the agenda.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next item up is item 11. It's a deputy director's report for the South Coast District, which includes both L.A. and Orange counties. I am sitting in for Sherilyn Sarb for the South Coast Orange County items and the San Diego items. We thought, given the light agenda, it made sense for me to come up here and present some items, Sherilyn's items, to save some money. So that's why I'm doing San Diego. Anyhow, the DDR's report includes a list of the waivers, immaterial amendments, and immaterial extensions for the district. Staff did receive a late letter of concern from a neighboring property owners association, the Regatta Homeowners Association, for immaterial amendment to Coastal Development Permit 582-323-A2, and that's in the deputy director's report. The applicant for this permit is the Nigel Beach Terrace Condominium Association. The Regatta Homeowners Association is generally in favor of the amendment, but they had raised several concerns regarding this amendment. The original permit was for a 400-unit condominium project on Pacific Coast Highway in Dana Point. The applicant is proposing to remove existing landscaping and plant new landscaping in a portion of the property fronting PCH, pursuant to a new landscape plan. The new landscape plan will open up view corridors along PCH that were required under the original permit. Concerns raised by the neighboring property owners association relate to maintaining tree height, tree maintenance issues, and these appear to be related to maintaining private views and not public views. The maximum natural height of the tree, of the new trees outside the view corridors, is 30 feet, and the applicant's CC&Rs require the trees to be maintained at a 35-foot height level. And the landscaping is all outside the view corridors, the trees, and will not affect any public views. Under the original permit, the applicant is required to maintain the view corridors and landscaping adjacent to PCH, and the new landscaping consists of drought-tolerant and non-invasive species. Therefore, staff is recommending this amendment remain on the district director's report as immaterial. Staff is not aware of any other opposition to the items in the district director's report, and we recommend the commission concur with the executive director's determination on these matters.
All right, thank you, staff. Any objection to finding concurrence? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
Item number 12, the Los Angeles County permits. Staff is recommending a move to the consent calendar, and staff is recommending one regular calendar item be moved to the consent calendar, and that item is item 14C, the Los Angeles County Department of Public Works application. There is an addendum for this item. Staff received a letter from Heal the Bay. Heal the Bay supports the project, but asks if there is evidence that the increased storm flow stemming from the cleaning of a culvert into Colorado Lagoon and the construction of a channel will not bring an increase of contaminants from the marina. And this project is for a new storm drain with low flow diversion that diverts flows away from Colorado Lagoon and into Marine Stadium in the city of Long Beach. In addition, Heal the Bay is requesting data regarding sediment samples and water quality monitoring data be made available to the public. The cleaning of the culvert to Colorado Lagoon or a new channel to the lagoon is related to the Colorado Lagoon Restoration Project, which will be carried out by the city of Long Beach. The proposed project is not related in any way to that future project, so those are unrelated items. With regard to sediment sampling data and water quality monitoring data, the sediment sampling data associated with this project is listed in the EIR for the project. The City of Long Beach is responsible for monitoring water quality in Marine Stadium and Colorado Lagoon, not the county. The City Health Department routinely tests waters of the Marine Stadium and Colorado Lagoon because of public health concerns, and this data is publicly available from the City of Long Beach. Staff recommends the commission vote and approve this item.
All right, thank you. And for the record, we have one speaker, Mr. Dingman, but he's here for questions only, and it's from the Los Angeles County Department of Public Works. Is that correct? All right. Thank you, sir. Are there any ex parte communications regarding item 14A, which has been moved to the consent calendar? Seeing none, what's the pleasure of the commission? We have a motion by Commissioner Potter.
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Kruer to approve the consent calendar. Any objections to a unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the consent calendar is approved.
The next item is item 15A, and this is a development agreement between the City of Santa Monica and related Santa Monica Village LLC. The development agreement outlines the obligation, terms, and conditions between the City of Santa Monica and the project developer for a large mixed-use project located in the Civic Center area of the city. In September of this year, the Commission approved a coastal development permit for the development. And pursuant to Government Code 65869, a development agreement that pertains to property within the coastal zone in an uncertified area must be approved by the Commission. The proposed development agreement is consistent with the previously approved CDP and the Coastal Act, and staff is recommending approval as submitted. The motion for approval can be found on page 2 of the staff report, and this concludes staff's presentation on this item.
All right. Thank you, staff. Let me check for ex parte communications. Seeing none, let me bring it back to the commission. We have no speakers on this item.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Clark.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move that the Commission approve Development Agreement 5-08-278 as submitted and recommend a yes vote.
All right. Is there a second? We have a motion by Commissioner Clark, a second by Commissioner Potter to the maker and seconder recommending a yes vote. Passage of the motion will result in the approval of the development agreement. Would you like to speak to your motion?
No.
No? All right. Is there any objection to unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the motion is approved. The Commission hereby approves the development agreement on the grounds that the development would be in conformity with the provisions of Chapter 3 of the Coastal Act. Thank you.
The next item, item 16, the Orange County District Director's Report items were reported to the Commission under item number 11. So I'm moving on to item number 16A. The City of Laguna Beach is requesting an amendment to the implementing ordinances of its certified LCP to replace noise standards that exist in two places in the certified implementation plan with a reference to similar standard in the noise ordinance chapter 7.25, the municipal code, which is not part of the city's LCP, certified LCP. The amendment is a cleanup measure to consolidate all noise standards into one ordinance. The standards are being moved from sections of the certified LIP are not necessary components of the LCP to conform to the Coastal Act requirements, and the noise ordinance will not supersede or replace any standards that exist in the LUP to protect coastal resources, such as ESHA. The LCP amendment is considered minor by the executive director because it does not change the kind, intensity, or density of use and is consistent with a certified land use plan. Notice of the minor amendment has been circulated to the interested parties and no objections have been received. And in accordance with the commission's regulation, the executive director must report the minor LCP amendment to the commission and any objections. And we haven't received any objections. So that concludes my comments on that item.
Okay. Are there any objections to finding concurrence from the commission? Seeing none, the commission concurs.
Item number 17 are the permit items staff is recommending move to the consent calendar, and staff is recommending one item be moved to the consent calendar, and that item is item 18A, the Nador application. And there is just one little minor change to the staff report in your addendum packet regarding the provision of reference to water cannons. Change that reference to curtain sprinkler system, which is designed to douse the exterior of the structure during a wildfire. And staff there recommends the commission vote and approve this item.
Okay, item 18A is being moved to the consent calendar. Commissioner Wan, you had a question?
Let's see if I've got my... Okay, just a question. I was fascinated by the thermally activated water curtains. This has nothing to do with whether or not I'm in favor of the project, which is fine. And what kind? Maybe there are contractors or developers here who know what that is. But it seemed to me that if this is something that helps
reduce the level or the amount of fire clearance needed, and the fire department did reduce that for them. It might be something that we need to find out about. I certainly would like to find out about it for my own home.
Yeah.
Yeah, there. I have some experience with this in the Santa Monica Mountains, and these sensors are placed around the home. And as the fire approaches, the heat activates these sensors and then kicks on a pump system that douses the home in a water curtain that's designed into the structure itself.
But something that we should think about in terms of maybe recommending to folks to put in their homes, so that we don't have to have, because brush clearance really has an adverse impact on ESHA, and if it is something that they can use to reduce that brush clearance, I think it's something we ought to think about, and I certainly would appreciate it if staff would send me some information, whatever you have, about who manufactures this. I mean, it was clear when it's thermally activated, apparently at 200 degrees it turns on, you know, it kicks it on, but I'd kind of like to find out more about that.
And I think...
Yeah, we'll I'll forward you that information. I know some developers or some contractors. I have no idea.
You know, when you're protecting your home in those areas, it's almost irrelevant.
And then we'll have to find the water.
Okay. All right, we have item 18A that's been moved to the consent calendar. Commissioner Clark?
I move approval of the consent calendar.
All right, is there a second? Moved by Commissioner Clark, seconded by Commissioner Potter to approve the consent calendar. Is there any objection to unanimous roll call vote on this item? Seeing none, the consent calendar is approved. Next item.
I'm sorry. Item number 19. This is the Deputy Director's report for the San Diego District. And there are three waivers in the District Director's report, and staff is not aware of any opposition to these waivers and recommends the Commission concur with the Executive Director's determination on these matters.
Okay. Any objection to concurring? Seeing none, the Commission concurs.
Next item is item number 20, and these are the permanent items staff is recommending be moved to the consent calendar, and staff is recommending one regular calendar item be moved to the consent calendar, and that item is item 21A, the Party Homes application. The conditions of approval are acceptable to the applicant, and there is no known opposition, and therefore staff recommends the Commission approve this item on the consent calendar.
Okay, we have no speaker slips on 21A, I believe. We do have a speaker slip on 21A. This is Jimmy Ayala, and you're here available for questions. Is that correct? All right, thank you, sir. And what's the pleasure of the committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
We have a motion by Commissioner Kruger. Is there a second? Second by Commissioner Potter. They're recommending a yes on the consent calendar. Is there any objection to a unanimous roll call vote on this matter? Seeing none, the consent calendar is approved.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm going to do 22A and C as impersonating Sherilyn Light. These are findings on the Pacifica Company's hotel in Imperial Beach, and as you recall, the Commission approved this condominium hotel for 100% of the units with special findings as to why this was a unique situation in Imperial Beach, and we think that the findings reflect the Commission's action and ask for your adoption.
Okay, we have... see if we have any speaker slips on this. I have no speaker slips on 22A. So do we have any ex parte communications from commissioners disclosed? Seeing none, I'll bring it back to the commission. The motion's on page 3. Commissioner Kruger.
Madam Chair, I move that the commission adopt the revised findings in support of the commission's action on April 10, 2008 concerning approval of the coastal development permit number A6. IMB-07-131 and recommend a yes vote.
Is there a second? We have a motion by Commissioner Kruger and a second by Commissioner Clark. Passage of the motion will result in adoption of the revised findings in the staff report. Would you like to speak to your motion?
No, I just one comment. I'd say I think staff did an excellent job in
memorializing this. All right. Can we get a show of hand of those commissioners eligible to vote?
5, 6, 7. Thank you.
All right.
Item B was misnoticed, and it's actually item C that we're on now, and that's on the addendum. Those are the revised findings for the City of Oceanside, the amendment for the downtown district. I think we have now resolved all the outstanding issues here and won't go back over them, and I think the findings now reflect the Commission's action. Ask for your approval.
We had a speaker slip for 22B, but that item was withdrawn.
Yes, and she knows that item C is really the one that relates to the City of Oceanside. And I think the city's in agreement with us, I hope.
Okay, thank you. Let me just ask if there are an ex parte communications regarding this. Seeing none, then we'll go to the speaker from the City of Oceanside.
Mic on.
You're on.
It's a pleasure to be here after the process, and we thank
you. Could you give your name for the record?
Jane McVeigh, City of Oceanside.
Thank you.
We thank you for your support. We thank the staff for working with us on the LCPA, and we would ask for your support for the revised findings today.
All right. Thank you, Ms. McVeigh. Pleasure of the commission. Commissioner Kruger?
Madam Chair, I move the revised findings asked for a yes vote.
Second.
We have a motion by Commissioner Kruger and a second by Commissioner Clark to approve the findings. Would you like to speak to your motion?
No, ma'am.
Commissioner Clark?
No.
All right. Could we get a show of hands of those eligible to vote on this item?
Seven.
All right. Yes. Thank you.
Madam Chair, we are going to have we're going to be challenged with a quorum tomorrow, so I would ask those of you who are going to be here, please to be here at 9. As I indicated before, we are going to have the federal evaluation as part of the Commission's public hearing tomorrow, as well as our regular agenda. So with that, I think we've completed the day's agenda.
We have a closed session.
Can we have a closed session?
And then you have some public comment.
Two public comments. I'm just finding out if we have need for a closed session, and then we'll go to the public comment. We do. All right. Okay, we have two speakers for public comment, and the first is Ed Mountford.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ed Mountford with Hearthside Homes. First of all, congratulations to Commissioner Neely and Burke for their election to the leadership positions. The reason I'm here this morning is really as a follow-up to the last meeting down in Long Beach in November, where I had committed to the Commission that I would come back this month and update you on the status of the reburial of the human remains that were found at our project site, Brightwater, in Huntington Beach. And oh, I'm sorry. It sounded loud from here, but okay. Because I only have, obviously, a very short time here, I'm asking staff to pass out a letter that we put together for the Native American Heritage Commission. The commission is taking this item up on their agenda tomorrow down in San Juan Capistrano, and it really outlines, the first four pages are really get to the issues that Anthony Morales, the most likely descendant from the Gabrieleño tribe, brought to the commission's attention at the November meeting. And let me cut right to the chase and say that now that we've completed the documentation of the artifacts, we are ready to proceed with reburial next month. So we're ready to get those Native American remains back into the ground. The Native American Heritage Commission, it's my understanding, is going to be making a recommendation in this regard tomorrow during the course of their meeting, and I'm assuming that they would want to see reburial as soon as possible as well. I did want to explain something to you, though, because it's not really as straightforward as it all seems. At Bolsa Chica, because it sits on the northern end of the Juaneño Band of Mission Indians territory and on the southern end of the Gabrieleños, we have two most likely descendants assigned to our project to provide us with recommendation on how to handle, culturally sensitive materials. And one of the most likely to send is David Balardis with the Juaneños. He's been on the project for 20 years. Mr. Morales was just appointed 15 months ago. And so essentially what's happened is Mr. Morales' views and his cultural views differ from Mr. Balardis. And so sometimes they don't always agree on how we should handle things. And that's a position we found ourselves in numerous times over the last year. For example, we were prepared to rebury the human remains last April, but Mr. Morales asked us to do some additional documentation on some artifacts before things were reburied. So we proceeded with that. And so that's what delayed it. So there, it's not as straightforward as it all may seem. It's very complex. And so I'm hoping that we'll be able to get these things back in the ground next month, and the Native American Heritage Commission will be pleased with that. And if you have the opportunity to read through this, again, really the first four pages really address Mr. Morales' concern. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mark Massaro?
Madam Chair, Commissioners, I have two items I'd like to talk to you briefly about, and the first involves a website in Santa Barbara called GalitaSurfing.com. This is photographs along the Gaviota coast that were just posted this week. This is the famous Dos Pueblos golf course site that many years ago you denied a mile-long golf course along the ocean for the existence of endangered species, Gaviota tar plant, white-tail kites, wetlands, and other resources. It's owned by the Macar Company, which should ring familiar to you. You've dealt with their Coastal Act violations at the St. Regis Resort, as well as approved a resort concept plan for them in Huntington Beach. Suffice it to say, there'll be no giant resorts on the rural Gaviota coast, but Macar is moving forward with an EIR and a plan to build several high-end mansions that are adjacent to the well-publicized ancient Naples lots that the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors recently approved a project on that property. Meanwhile, for many years, Macar has engaged in a campaign of terror against surfers and people seeking to use long-held, well-established public access trails along this part of the coast. I have reported to you periodically in the last 5 years of their erection of fences. They've moved the property lines closer to the 101 freeway, and for the past 2 years have been maintaining armed security guards at various entrances to the property. Last week, they really kicked that program into high gear with all kinds of security cars along the coast here, night lighting, and other obstructions designed to harass and intimidate surfers and the public that are attempting to use this part of the coastline. This is really something that you've got to deal with, and we urge your staff to take a look at this. The next item I wanted to bring to your attention was Hobo Aliso Ridge in Laguna Beach. Perhaps as a direct result to your finding of no vested rights to continue to destroy endangered habitat on Hobo Aliso Ridge last month, the city of Laguna immediately responded by announcing that starting next week, they're going to clear all vegetation on Hobo Aliso Ridge due to their concerns over fire. Now, the irony of this plan is that it's the middle of winter, and next week, the weather forecast is that it's going to rain in Laguna Beach. So you really can't just deal with Athens group on this. We've got to express to the city that it's inappropriate to be clearing endangered habitat during the middle of winter in Laguna. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that is the last speaker for public comment. So we will go ahead and adjourn today and reconvene tomorrow at 9. Oh, no, we have our closed session. I'm sorry.
Right.
So we're going to just ask the public to leave now so we can start our closed session.